Welcome to Orphaned Entertainment, the podcast dedicated to public domain and abandoned media. I'm your host, Christopher, and riding shotgun with me on this journey through dusty drama and deadly grudges, it's Lydia.
I'm digging in my brain for something witty to say, but it's struggling. Hi. howdy, folks.
There you howdy. Go. Exactly.
Cleverness arrives. Ding.
Before we go any further, thanks everyone for tuning in to this month's episode. Orphan Entertainment is available wherever you get your podcasts and wherever you choose to listen. If you have the option to do so, please rate and review the show. That does help get the show in front of more eyes and hopefully into more ears. Another great way to help is just by sharing the episode you're listening to on whatever social media platform you use. And you can follow the link in the show notes to find our social media sites. You can also follow that link to our YouTube channel, where you can watch many of the films we have covered here on the show. If you'd like to email us with any comments, suggestions, or feedback on this or any episode, please type or record a message and send it to orphanedentertainment@gmail.com. Let's listen to an Ellery Queen one-minute mystery and a promo for another podcast. And when we return, we'll hit the trail to Surango with Deadly Companions.
Ellery Queen's Minute Mysteries. This is Ellery Queen with a case I call The Genuine Article. A rich American woman named Carlyle came to me to check on a man who wanted to marry her. He claims he's a member of the House of Lords, she told me. He showed me photos of his manor house in Scotland and an apartment in Edinburgh, but seriously, I think he's a fraud. What makes you so sure, I asked. She replied, he told me he was elected to the House of Lords. They're not elected, they're appointed by the Queen. What do you think? In a moment, my answer.
Hello.
Ahoy.
My name is Adam.
And I'm Nick.
And this is the Bottom of the Stream podcast.
A never-ending quest to find hidden movie gems on Netflix.
Every week we watch a random movie that we find on the stream and we talk about it for about an hour.
Yeah, as well as that, we round up the news of the week and we usually mention what we've been watching at the top of the stream.
Yeah, so if you're into Netflix and you enjoy watching stuff on there, give us a listen.
Join us aboard our podcast boat as we navigate the perilous water.
Available now wherever you get your podcasts.
In the case of The Genuine Article, the man was indeed that. He was from Scotland, where some members of the House of Lords of the British Parliament are elected. Miss Carlyle, now Mrs. McTavish, has moved to Scotland. Listen again to Ellery Queen's Minute Mysteries.
Deadly Companions is a 1961 Western starring Maureen O'Hara, who also sings the opening song, Brian Keith, Steve Cochran, and Chill Wills. This film is public domain because the producers failed to put a copyright notice on the film. And then no effort was made to re-up any copyright on the 28th year after production, as per the law at the time. The film was produced by Maureen O'Hara's younger brother, Charles Fitzsimmons. Star Brian Keith suggested the producer and director of his recently canceled television series, The Westerner, to direct this film, making it famed director Sam Peckinpah's feature film debut. He, of course, would go on to direct the Academy Award-nominated The Wild Bunch in 1969. In this film, a stranger rides into town and helps another man who is being tortured by some of the locals for cheating at cards. The stranger, the man he helped, Turk, and Turk's friend Billy hatch a plan to rob the local bank. When someone beats them to the punch, there's a shootout in the street, and a stray bullet from the stranger's gun kills the young son of a local dance hall girl, Kit. Kit, determined to take her son to be buried alongside her late husband in the distant town of Surango, refuses any help from the stranger and his cohorts, despite Surango being deep in Apache territory. But the men insist and follow Kit, eventually come to her aid when her wagon breaks down while fording a creek. Eventually, the truth of why the stranger helped Turk comes to light, and a battle between honor and vengeance, as well as survival, ensues. Maureen O'Hara was raised in Dublin, Ireland, and trained at the Rathmines Theatre Company from the age of 10 until she moved into the Abbey Theatre when she turned 14. She did a screen test for a local studio but was declared unsatisfactory. But Charles Laughton saw it and saw potential in her, and he arranged for her to co-star with him in 1939's Jamaica Inn, which we covered way back in December of 2016.
Yes.
Seriously, 9 years ago?
I can't believe it. It still stands out as one of those movies that whenever I see it, I go, oh, I want to watch that again.
Or maybe it was December, so it wasn't quite 9 years.
It's been a bit.
It's been a bit.
The world has changed.
O'Hara moved to Hollywood that same year to appear with Laughton in The Hunchback of Notre Dame and was awarded a contract with RKO Pictures. The Queen of Technicolor, as O'Hara was sometimes credited, would go on to star and work with some of the biggest names in Hollywood at the time. John Ford, Tyrone Power, Natalie Wood, and John Wayne, whom she may be most closely associated. She worked consistently into the 1960s, only retiring from film in 1971. She did return to the screen 20 years later to appear with John Candy in 1991's Only the Lonely. Brian Keith was born into a family of actors. His father was Robert Keith, a prolific character actor whose career spanned from 1924 through the early 60s. Wow. His mother, Helena Shipman, was a stage actress, but should not be confused with the more successful Broadway actress, Helen Shipman. Brian Keith began appearing on television in the 1940s on shows such as Hands of Mystery, Tales of Tomorrow, and Police Story. In 1953, he made his feature film debut in Paramount Pictures' Western Arrowhead and made several more pictures for the studio before moving to Columbia in 1954. He continued to appear in several TV series and in 1955 starred in his own called Crusader. Keith bounced from film and television, having success in both mediums, including the 1961 Disney hit The Parent Trap, where he played the father of Haley Mills and Haley Mills, and this film also co-starred Maureen O'Hara. In 1966, he got the role of Uncle Bill in the CBS series Family Affair. He'd earned 3 Emmy nominations for the role, and the series would run for 5 seasons and a total of 138 episodes. He continued to work in film and television until his death in 1997. His last appearance was in 97's Rough Riders, where he played President William McKinley. Director John Milius dedicated the film to Brian Keith, actor, Marine, and raconteur. That's actually all the little background information I have, other than mentioning that this film was largely recorded in Arizona. So it's like legit, like it's a Western filmed out West. Yes.
Well, I don't usually have much to contribute, but I have a little couple of things.
Excellent. Good.
Steve Cochran plays Billy, who is one of the two men that kind of picks up with Brian Keith's main character. And I kept thinking he looked and sounded like familiar to me. His name sounded familiar. I dug into it just a little bit and found out that he is in a favorite Danny Kaye movie of mine called Wonder Man, where Danny Kaye plays his own twin. Steve Cochran actually plays the bad guy in it. Maybe not surprising once we start talking about this movie, but really, really fun to see him and go, why does this guy look so familiar? He looks really familiar. Wonder why. Turns out he was in an old Danny Kaye movie that I love. The other piece of information that's super interesting to me is that the writer, Albert Sidney Fleischman, one of the other Fleischman, wrote this movie, but he based it off of a book he had written. It's based on the book The Deadly Companions, but Albert Sidney Fleischman is better known as Sid Fleischman, who wrote a ton of children's books, including a series called The Bloodhound Gang, which was on PBS. So it's really interesting. This movie is, I think, a really serious film, but he is actually much better known for winning tons and tons of literary awards for his children's books. So I have pulled a couple of those out. I'm super excited to explore them. They're a little bit hard to find at this point, but I did find The Whipping Boy and I found another one I'm excited to check out, and we'll see how those go. But if you are a kid or have kids, it might be looking into Sid Fleischman's books, because he was really well known for a very long time and was just got tons and tons of awards.
Excellent. Very interesting. A Bloodhound. I hadn't thought of them in ages.
Yeah. I read it and was like, wait, the what? The what? He did a... That's wild. There's so many... this movie is kind of funny. It is peppered with people whose names you recognize. Chill Wills was in McClintock and Mimi in St. Mm-hmm. Louis and just tons and tons and tons of other stuff. But, you know, just one of those actors that was in so much stuff, but he was somebody's weird uncle or something. So we may not always think about him. But in this movie, he reminds me so much of a relative of mine. It kind of blew my mind a couple of times. In this particular character, too, not because he's a little bit off his rocker, but just there are scenes in it where the lighting hits him just right and looks like a relative of mine. So
a little bit
strange. Yeah, a little interesting.
That's awesome. Yeah, I'm trying to find a little bit more information on some of them. I don't know why. I just sort of I figured we'd probably talked a bit about Maureen O'Hara back in 2016, so I didn't want to repeat myself. I wanted to give a little refresher because it's been almost a decade. But everyone else, I'll admit, I probably gave a little bit of a short shrift on because I know like Chill Wills has definitely had a huge career. He's worked with the same sort of people that I was mentioning with the Maureen O'Hara, you know.
Yes.
Like you said, McClintock with John Wayne. He was also the guy was also a singer as mm-hmm. well as an actor. And yes. I love the idea of seeing someone who plays a character like he does in this as Turk, and to think this guy could clean up and actually sing and be good at it. I think that's hilarious.
Yeah, definitely. Well, and I don't think that they're related at all, but they're... Oh, no, I totally said that wrong. They are related. James O'Hara plays the shopkeeper in this as well and is Maureen O'Hara's brother. And
right.
I think you said he is the producer in it as well, but... Interesting that he shows up in it as a character, too.
Well, the producer is actually a different brother. This was a family affair.
It
yeah.
is, then.
Yeah, Maureen O'Hara's, I think, was she born of Fitzsimmons and changed
That's
her name?
Right. You did say a different last name, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So Charles Fitzsimmons is her younger brother. He's the one that produced it. I think it was an older brother. Jim O'Hara plays the store owner. That tries to help her out a little bit in this film.
Yeah.
And so I thought that it was a lot of fun. And it kind of goes into how this film was even made. I think it was one of these cases where the people involved wanted to make the film, but were struggling a little bit, you know, couldn't get really kind of major studio funding sort of mm-hmm. thing. So I think that's where Charles Fitzsimmons kind of stepped in and threw some money, and they're able to then get distributed by Pathé America and internationally Warner Brothers.
So interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I love hearing that kind of story and seeing where people really pulled for a movie.
Yeah. And then the fact that they were able to get somebody, and well, actually that might be why they kind of had to go with effectively an untested director. While he did kind of cut his teeth in television, you know, he had not done any film mm-hmm. For Peckinpah. Mm-hmm. And it was, well, I worked with this guy. He produced and directed this show I worked on. Maybe mm-hmm. he could do it. And sure, let's give it to him. So, yes, the fact that this is a practically an independent film, at least as independent as it could get in 1961, helps bring in a lot of these talents that would then later go on to do bigger and better things. Although I think Maureen O'Hara was probably the main big star at this point. Although, honestly, most of her big star stuff was probably the decade prior.
I feel like by the 60s she was kind of wrapping up is what I was trying to say.
She was changing.
She wasn't as young as she was when she first started.
Obviously. Yeah. That's how people age.
That's another one of my creative intelligent comments today, guys. But yeah, she, you know, I imagine she was getting to an age where she was starting to feel like a middle-aged woman, and does she want to continue to age into older and older roles? She looks so young in this movie, though, surprisingly young. And I think she's playing a character a few years younger than she actually is at this time. because at one point we get to see her husband's, spoiler alert, her husband's gravestone, and it says he died at the age of 22, and her son is probably 10, 11. Mm-hmm. And so she's playing somebody in her maybe early 30s, if not younger. And I think she was older than that by the time she's playing this role.
She's in at least 40, if not 41 years old at this point.
I would think so. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to say I was somebody a decade younger than her actual age, but she looks phenomenal. You wouldn't know if you didn't know that she had this big, you know, history of other roles that she had played.
And they even give her a little bit of a cheesecake shot in this film where she's her clothes have to dry out. And so she's kind of hiding behind a wagon, but her legs are in full display.
And her shoulders.
And I remember I was watching the film and I had the note. That's a great looking leg.
She is phenomenally pretty. She has an amazing figure. And there's a second shot too, where she's bathing at night, and it's, you know, very dark, kind of grainy shot. But, you know, again, you can see a bit of her back and her shoulders, and, you know, she turns and is startled by something. Of course it doesn't show anything because of Hays Code, but, they definitely, I almost said monetize. Gosh, what a modern phrase to use. They definitely push the sexuality factor of her in this movie, which is interesting. I mean, again, she's a beautiful, beautiful woman in this film, always is a beautiful woman. But she's a little bit older than you would usually expect for that kind of a shot to take place. Right. Oh, also, just mentioning Sam Peckinpah, I did see that he also had some writing credits under his name, which I thought was very interesting. And I think he has a writing credit on The Wild Bunch, too. He's credited as the writer, at least mm-hmm. one of the writers on that and a few other things. But I can't hear the name Sam Peckinpah without thinking of Lou Peckinpah from The Cheap Detective. Uh-huh. So it's always going to be a thing. But
that's funny.
Yeah. A lot of interesting to see how talented, and this is the early part of some of these people's careers, or, you know, the early film part of some of these people's careers, but there's so much talent in this movie.
Oh, very much so. You know, it's interesting. We were talking about Maureen O'Hara, she's 41 years old, you know, playing effectively the love interest, you know, mm-hmm. the woman of everyone's
after.
Yeah, the woman that everyone is after in the film. And that is very different than what you're used to seeing. Mm-hmm. And even in the 1960s, certainly in the decades prior to this, you're going to have the 20-something.
Yes.
Starlet, or, you know, the ingenue or something, you mm-hmm. know, playing these
Ben
roles.
Fatale.
And it's a precursor to, I think, to the direction where films would go decades later that people kind of give credit for being so different. I'm thinking of like when Clint Eastwood did Unforgiven, mm-hmm. and suddenly there's all these older actors, you know, in their roles and this and that. I'm like, well, it's not as creative as you would like to think.
Yeah, it is. It's a little unusual to see it, but I think that in this case, like, it definitely was a good decision. I have a hard time, having seen this movie, imagining somebody else playing her role. I definitely can't think of anybody off the top of my head that I go, oh, you know who would have been great in this? I guess we should start talking about the movie instead of just the actors' ages and their credits. but yeah, so the movie, we watched it.
we did indeed. I was just last final point is just about the ages, is that it was very interesting and was kind of refreshing to see a film starring effectively middle-aged
people. Yeah, yeah. Because Brian Keith is no spring chicken in this either.
He's about the same age as Maureen O'Hara was at this point. Yeah. I mean,
and he looks mature. He doesn't, he's not a young looking guy trying to play older.
Yeah. Even Steve Cochran as Billy is not a young man. He's about the same age. In fact, if like Wiki is to believed, he's older than either one of them.
That's wild.
By several years.
Yeah, he looks so young in it.
He does. No, he looks like you could easily, if you told me he was 20 or 30 something, I would have believed it in this film.
I absolutely agree. I think the reason I recognized him was because he looks so much like he did in the film that I saw him in, that I know him from. Excuse me, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, 1945, so 16 years earlier is the movie that I know him from.
Right.
And he was in a number of other notable movies. Don't mistake that, you know, he was a one-hit wonder or anything like that. He's got a lot of credits under his belt. And so seeing him in 1961 and he still looks very similar to when, you know, in 1945 is pretty crazy. All of them are mature, though. And maybe that's part of what's going on with this movie, is that you have a bunch of mature actors that already know their craft. And so I think Sam Peckinpah does an amazing job, and he proves it in his career that he's very good at what he does. But I wonder if this wasn't just an easy job for him too.
You know, it's real funny. I had this note. I didn't include it in my notes at the beginning of this show, but Maureen O'Hara, in her memoir, Tis Herself, well, that was published in 2004. She actually complained about Peckinpah on the set. And she says that, quote, he didn't have a clue how to direct a movie and was one of the strangest and most objectionable people I ever worked with.
How interesting. I'm very interested to pick that apart. I think we're going to have to start talking about the movie now to talk about that.
Yeah, absolutely.
But, you know, the film starts off with this whole movie the whole time gave me, I kept thinking of Silverado.
Mm-hmm.
And it's strange. It's such a, Once Upon a Time in the West. Can't believe I didn't remember. It's Sergio Leone.
Of course, yeah.
I kept getting really strong Silverado and, oh my God, I just lost it again. Once Upon a Time in the West.
Yeah.
I was getting vibes of those two movies the whole time that I was watching this. It starts off with this guy that they call Yellow Legs. They just assign him a nickname, mm-hmm. which at first I kind of missed why, but he's a former Northern soldier, and he's still wearing his uniform pants with the yellow stripe on it to indicate that he's a sergeant. I assume to indicate that he's a sergeant.
I think the yellow stripe was just, that was the uniform was of the Northern Army. Yeah.
All right. Hi, Dad. He's just shaking his head at me right now. But so they're calling him Yellow Legs because of that. And, you know, Yankee the whole time. At first I was like, why are they calling him Yank? Like, how do they know where he's from? But it's because he's still wearing the bottoms of his uniform. And at this point, I have to pause and say the costuming in this is phenomenal. It's understated. You're unlikely to notice it, but there's a scene where they're hunkered up against a rock and you can real clearly see what he's wearing. And the stripe on his pants is kind of frayed and falling mm-hmm. apart a little bit. And his clothes are weathered and they look like they've been lived in and worn. And it's in the 50s, it was very common to have a cowboy riding out and his clothes are pristine and it just looks wrong. And I think this is a sign of what they're moving into in the 60s, of kind of that more raw, gritty realism. But the costuming in this whole thing is so good. He ends up he walks into a bar and they're hanging a man. The guy's balancing on a rolling barrel.
Yeah.
And, you know, he makes a comment about having a dance and they're like, you know, he's a five ace card player. And, you know, you're waiting for him. This guy's about to hang. He's about to fall off this barrel and hang. And you know, as it transpires, this guy decides to save him after seeing his hand, which is kind of a weird reason to want to save somebody. So, you know, they do a really good job of setting up the mystery of everything that's going on early in this movie. From the very beginning, it's funny that somebody would say he's not skilled, he doesn't know what's going on, because the first scene of this movie sets it up so well. I feel like it was one of those where the movie started off and I was kind of like, okay, here we go. And then within a matter of seconds, I was like, oh, wait, what's going on? What's happening here? And I was immediately captivated and engaged. So it's interesting to say, oh, the director doesn't know what he was doing. But this is one of those movies that as soon as you start watching it, you want to know what's going to happen next. And what happens, of course, is that he stops the hanging for some reason we don't understand and runs off with these two guys to go to a town that has a, I think they said, an old sheriff and a new bank. I loved that phrase in here. It's like, oh, I think, you know, the writing throughout the whole thing is very good. The storyline, I think, is very good. But when we first see Maureen O'Hara, they've gotten to this new town with the new bank and the old sheriff. It's Gila, I believe is what it's called. And they are going into the bar and all these people are arranging chairs and coming in their Sunday best.
Well, this ain't Sunday, is it?
That's a matter of opinion in Gila City. We haven't seen the calendar in 2 years. Some folks hold it Monday, but these folks, they hold it Sunday. You gents looking for a drink?
I'm looking right at it. What's in that bottle?
Best we've got. Even the mayor drinks it.
That'll have to do. Tell me something. How about the bank? How do they hold?
The bank's open. They're Monday folks. The bar's closed when the parson walks in.
And I love the bartender who has got like window shades that he's pulling down over the
the portrait of the lady,
yes,
exposed.
Yes, the reverend doesn't like to look at him while he's preaching.
I love that line, while he's preaching. Not the reverend doesn't want to see it. The reverend doesn't like to look at it while he's preaching.
Distracts him.
So, right? So funny. And then we see Maureen O'Hara come in with this little boy that there's been an interaction with briefly on the street. And her outfit in this is just like upstanding, nice, casual,
Sunday best.
Normal lady. Sunday best for a normal lady. And people are giving her looks and all this. As it transpires, after this scene, she leaves. And when she comes back in, she is in a dance hall girl's outfit. She's wearing the black slinky thing with the red off the shoulder. And then the next time we see her, after her son has been shot, she's in navy up to her neck with a shawl pulled around her. The attention to the costuming in this is so good. They could have just left her in the dance hall girl outfit the whole time, and it would have felt really disingenuous. But they pay attention to each step as they're going through it. And I think in a way they had to do that. Because one of the key elements of this movie is that the guy they're calling Yellow Legs refuses to take his hat off for anything. He won't even take his hat off to the Lord. And with that kind of focus on somebody's item of apparel, if you neglect everybody else's, there's going to be a huge imbalance. But it's worth noting. I think the costuming in this is just really well done. Over a 5-minute period.
No, I did like the fact that people were, as you said, you know, look like they were lived in, worn in, worked in clothes. Mm-hmm. No one looked like they came right out of the store. Mm-hmm. The characters are all interesting because, yes, you've got a man with no name. We never find out who Yellow Legs is. He's either Yellow Legs or Yankee. Yeah, no name is ever given.
I think in the last scene, maybe he gives an actual name.
I don't believe he does. I don't think we ever find out his name. Hmm. Even when it's just him and Kit talking, she asks,
is Yellow Legs a name? And he says, it's good enough.
Good enough for now. It'll yeah, do. That's it. And yeah, with the hat that he never takes off and no real explanation. We don't know why he saves Turk. Mm-hmm. At least not originally.
Not for a while.
Billy comes in. Billy just storms after Turk has been saved. Yeah. Turk, like, well, where have you been, Billy? You know, here's Turk's friend while he's getting hung, is off somewhere with the girls.
Yep. Yeah. And they don't introduce these characters. They don't introduce Kit.
No.
They don't say, I mean, you have the mutters, that's different, the mutterings of the people around her while she's attending the church service. But they don't say, oh, she came to town 10 years ago pregnant and she didn't have her husband with her. That's the woman there. They don't tell you anything about these characters, but they have a rich backstory. Mm-hmm. That's good writing.
Yeah, and you don't really... Well, they have a rich backstory, but you don't know all of it. Yes, Kit comes to town either a brand new mother or pregnant. Mm-hmm. Was she always a showgirl? Was that the only job she could find? You know, she's a single woman in the old West.
With a baby.
She's doing the whole, you know, well, my boyfriend in Canada, you know, sort of thing.
Right. But the reason it's so good is that you don't need to know the entire backstory. You can tell from the way the characters interact with each other that there is backstory. And mm-hmm. they don't have to introduce each character as they walk out. Every person doesn't have to walk on and announce their name and who where they're from and what they're, you know, whether they're a good guy or a bad guy. And that's part of the charm of this movie is you don't really know who's a good guy and a bad guy in this movie. I think you can argue that you don't really know who's a good guy or a bad guy in this movie until the very end, if even then.
I think everyone is painted with a shade of gray.
Mm-hmm.
I think we do find out who are some bad people, but even the good people.
Some morally bad people that are judging a woman that they don't know the history of. Yeah, that too.
Yeah.
Also. Yes.
But no, I was even thinking of like Billy and Turk are not good people.
They're not good people.
No. But as far as our hero here, you know, Yellow Legs, he is definitely what you would call the morally anti-hero. Gray.
Yeah,
he's the great, and you've always commented, and you're talking about the costuming and everything in here. Mm-hmm. I think it might be, maybe I'm reading into it, but maybe it's telling that Yellow Legs' hat is either a dirty white or a gray.
Yeah,
whereas Billy's is black.
Yes, well, I think even Billy like. He comes out of the back room with a bunch of girls, but it's interesting as they're going through this whole thing. Turk keeps saying, "Oh, Billy, if I could shoot the way you can, I'd just shoot that guy in the back." But Billy never does, and he has the opportunity over and over to do things that are really horrendous. He certainly. I'm about to say something that I'm sure somebody's going to get really offended with. Even though he is technically sexually assaulting Marino Hara in this, you're kind of getting the impression that he's looking for like a roll in the hay, not like it's like he likes the challenge and the pursuit, not necessarily that he's Grogan from the beginning of Romancing the Stone, and he's coming in and he's gonna take like you kind of there's and I, it might be an indicator of the time more than of the character, but you kind of get the idea that he's thinking this is just kind of fun and a little bit of a challenge. He doesn't, you know, jump on a woman right away and rip her clothes off. Now, you know, this is one of those moral graynesses. She's definitely not okay with it, so it's definitely not okay. But, you know, there's also, I think, more complexity to it than just this man is a rapist. So, you know, and he sees her as a dance hall girl, which he's used to dance hall girls being pretty open to his advances.
We don't really see any real true sharpshooter prowess out of Billy, do we? I wonder if he's more of a poser than
it's
he
possible.
Really is.
Yeah.
Because even when he comes out and he sees what's going on with Turk, and he goes to try to shoot the rope, and he misses several times.
Yeah.
And in the end, I don't even know if he ever hits it or if it's
if it
Yellow Legs that actually cuts the rope.
Yeah, I'm not sure either. That's an interesting question. Now, he definitely manages to, a little bit later, they're here in this town of Gila to rob the bank. And as they're going to about to rob the bank gets robbed. And Yellow Legs takes a shot at a guy, which is, of course, how he accidentally shoots the kid. But Billy takes a shot at a couple of guys and he hits him. And so there is definitely some skill there.
Yeah,
and we get the idea that he has the ability to shoot somebody if he wants to. But he's really in it for a good time. Like, mm-hmm. if it's interesting and fun and makes life more exciting, he's pretty much up for it. And then, you know, whenever he's bored, he's just going to wander away. He's a tsundere. He's he's a character that, like, might really, really care, but he's always going to pretend that he's bored or looking for something interesting to do.
He reminds me of the old Time Life book commercials, for those of us who are old enough, that would talk about Billy the Kid, a man so mean he once shot a kid or shot someone for snoring too loud.
Yeah.
I'm thinking that's this Billy.
And he's also not just like grumpy. He's not just like I'm trying to think who a comparable character would be. Just the guy that's always like grinding for a gunfight. What'd you say? Say it again in my face and I'll blow it off. He's not that kind of character. He's like, I could kill you if I wanted to, but it wouldn't be very interesting, so I'm not going to do it.
He's mischievous.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think Billy is the most interesting character in this because you get the fewest answered questions about him.
Mm-hmm.
With Turk, we eventually find out that he is, if not completely insane, certainly despicable.
Oh, yeah, very like, much.
Very despicable and problematic and clinging to some wild ideals that are pretty gross. Pretty awful. He wants to buy an army of slave Indians, his words, not mine, or Indian slaves, and train them up and have a march in line.
Put them in uniforms.
And he's going to have a gold braid and be the general, and he's going to run them through every town from here to Timbuktu. I forget.
This is a man that is a deserter of the Confederate Army.
Yes. And so he's, and he's not, this is not like a noble deserter or a noble, you know, soldier who lost, you know, who was part of a losing war. This is a guy who is, he is in it. He's bloodthirsty. And we know that he has, he's tortured, essentially. We find out eventually. I don't think I'm giving too much away because we do find this out fairly early. They're in Gila when we learn that he has tortured Yellow Legs and tried to, we figure out eventually, I don't know if I should give away what he tried to do to him or not, but
no,
it involved a knife. Yeah. and so he was torturing Yellow Legs with a knife when, you know, somehow the guy got away. And I think the worst part about Turk is he didn't even recognize him. So he's in here torturing somebody just for the hell of it. And now he wants to go and raise an army and just terrorize the countryside, and you don't know how to take him because he's clearly crazy. Like, he's really nuts, but he's delusional nuts.
Crazy, delusional. You get the impression that alcohol is probably, you know, a mainstay of his diet.
That's true, yeah.
And maybe at the time that he, I should say, you know, we find out that he at one point tortured Yellow Legs. This happened in the past. Mm-hmm.
About 5 years.
Five years or so.
Something, five or longer, yeah.
But Turk may have been blind drunk when it happened.
That's true.
Which is why he doesn't recognize him. It never even dawns on him.
Still a problem. A drunk person absolutely. Torturing her. Yeah. So there's a lot in this movie that there's like, wow, that's dark. You know, here you have Marina Hara's character. The whole time she's insisting, I was married, I had a husband. She moves to this town and all the women turn up their noses at her and are like,
imagine coming in here like she was respectable and bringing her woods cold with her. Imagine she wouldn't know his father if she saw him again.
Poor boy.
I imagine it's as close as she ever was to a parson, and her holding a prayer book like she was respectable.
They're going to heaven. Let you and me not go.
This is the closest she's ever been to a preacher, and all these horrible, horrible things that they're saying about her. And she later says, they branded me and my son the second we stepped foot into the town. And it's so she has had this really rough life. Maybe she had friends at the dance hall, but her son has been ostracized. She's had to raise a son that was his whole life sneered at and ostracized by the people of this town that she went to out of hope because the town she'd been living in was destroyed by the Apaches. It's like, wow, all of these people have incredibly dark histories. We don't really know about Billy. Maybe he had a dark history. There's an allusion at one point to him having been raised by Turk, but Turk is a crazy person, so I don't think we can take that at face value.
Yeah, I'm not sure how those two teamed up. It may be just a case of Kirk sort of glommed on to Billy, and Billy just found tolerates him humorous him. And tolerates yes. him.
Yeah. Like,
because
hey,
there's no love lost towards the end.
Or even at the beginning. Billy's not there yeah. looking out for him while he's getting hanged in the middle of a bar.
Right. Good point. Yeah. The whole film is covered with some pretty dark themes, even to the point, I mean, it's right in the synopsis of the film, no matter where you look, that Kit's son is shot yeah. in the crossfire during this bank robbery.
Yeah, and it's abrupt. There's no, like, sad music leading up to Lassie, you know, finding it. Like, it's just somebody's riding through town and bang, the kid's gone. Mm-hmm. And it's very, very shocking. It's and for that reason, really well done. Because, you know, you kind of have the feeling, oh, there's this woman and this kid. And so this kid is going to become, like, a part that bonds these people together. And, well, he does, but not the way you expect
it. Not the way
to.
You expect it. Oh. And what an interesting character trait to give our yellow legs. He's walking around with probably a bullet in his shoulder.
Yeah, they say it.
An old wound. Mm-hmm. And it's affected that that's his shooting arm. Yeah. And it's him trying to take a shot at the bank robber. And the pain of him trying to raise his arm is what makes him throw his shot. Mm-hmm. And that's the one that takes out the kid.
Yeah, he only gets one shot off.
Yeah.
And it's, yeah, it's, oh, yeah, it's this movie from the very beginning. It's like, not like a happy movie, but it's interesting and it's really captivating. There's a bit before that where they're still in the church meeting in the bar and the preacher is taken picks at the little boy. And he says, any man, woman, or child that says that they want to go to hell, like, I say let him go there. Go ahead and stand up right now and let him be counted. And Billy drops off his seat on the bar and lands with a thump. And everybody looks at him. And he elbows Turk and says, get on your feet. And Turk stands up. And the preacher says, are you saying you want to go to hell? And he says, yep, start counting. And everybody else get on your feet right now or I'm going to start shooting you. And they're like, what? And he shoots in the air and everybody gets to their feet. And there's that moment. It's like there's real comedy in there. There's some real humor in it. Of course, he's a despicable person, but he didn't hurt anybody through the whole movie. Like, he shoots at a bank robber, but he has multiple times he could shoot yellow legs. There are moments when you think, oh, he's definitely going to do something bad to Maureen O'Hara, but he doesn't. I mean, eventually he definitely tries to start something with her, but he has the opportunity time and time and time again to kill people for no good reason. And he doesn't, which is really interesting to me.
It's almost a, if you want to go to like, well, not modern. It was certainly going on at the time. He's like the Joker to Batman.
Mm-hmm. He's there to elbow him and rib him. But
right.
Hopefully he can make you trip and fall on your own face.
Yeah, I mean, some of the best Joker stories is these stories where he could kill somebody, but he decides it's funnier if he doesn't.
Yes. Yeah, very similar to that. So with her son dead, she decides to trek across it's technically the prairie, but it's the dry prairie, so it's probably more like a desert.
Yeah, very much.
Take her son back to bury him with his father, where he is supposedly buried in Sarango.
Come to change your mind, kid.
We've decided to have a nice funeral for the boy right here in Gila City.
The whole town will come. As mayor, I'll see to it.
Meade will be buried in Sarango, next to his father.
Now, kid.
Bury him here. You think I haven't heard all the whispering? You and your gossiping little wives with their pinched little faces and their noses in the air.
Now, Miss Kidd.
A dance hall woman with her freckle-faced woods colt. No telling who the father might be. They smell brimstone every time I walk by. They hated us both, me and the boy. Well, he's dead now. And you can tell your wives that there was no sinning. And there'll be no funeral. I'm taking him to Sarango.
You can't do that, Miss Kidd. It's smack in the middle of Apache country, and there ain't nobody willing to go with you.
Besides, there's not much of it left but the weeds.
I've tried, Kit. I've asked everybody.
I'm not asking anybody to go with me.
I love that. It's like, I'm not asking anybody to go with me. It, of course, all the town men are like, well, we'll pay for the funeral. We'll bury him right here. He's like, there has been no one here that has done anything other than sneer at me. And you want me to bury my son here?
Marino Hara has a few scenes in this movie where I'm like, whoa, this is one of them. And she doesn't do the crazy yelling woman, not crazy. I mean, she doesn't do the raised voice, flailing her arms. You people are horrible to me. She does the angry, bitter, low voice, and she gets the expression on her face is you're nasty, pinch-faced little wives. I've heard what they've said about me. She's so good in this scene. Mm-hmm. There are a couple of different scenes too where I would expect any other actress to raise her voice in defiance, and it's almost like her character is so scared she can't get the word out. So good. It's really, really good. Not at this particular scene. This particular scene, she's just full of venom, and it's really well done. And then she's given an umbrella that the shopkeeper can't sell to protect her complexion across the desert, which is like, All right, all you suffragettes, let's have a conversation right now. Really? The important thing is to protect her complexion across the desert? That's what you're gonna give her an umbrella. Like, and it's, I think he's being kind. I genuinely think the shopkeeper is trying to look out for her, but it's like, wow. The fact that her complexion is in the future going to be the most important thing for her when her son was just shot is like, oh, these people, like people in general, this era, yes, this time frame. Wow. Oh, my goodness.
So, yeah. So Yellow Legs, pretty much out of guilt, insists on trying to help her, whether she wants it or not.
Yeah.
And he keeps Billy and Turk with him. Because he effectively just tells him,
sheer force of will.
Yeah, you're staying with me. Because he, as we kind of have figured out by now, he's got an interest in Turk.
Yeah.
So he keeps Billy and Turk with him. And so they all just follow her into the desert.
Yeah. Until basically she's just stuck with them.
Mm-hmm.
And then, Billy, of course, makes his move and Yellow Legs stops him, as you should, and for just a minute we see his hat gets knocked off, but we don't see what's going on, and he puts his hat back on and kicks Billy out of the camp, sends him off on his own. Turk says, you can't send him out into Apache territory on his own, he could die out there, and Yellow Legs basically says, do you think I care? Like,
right.
he's gone, and then when they get up in the morning, Turk has gone as well.
Yes, and so Yellow Legs has to make that decision whether to go after Turk, who he's been tracking for 5 years,
yep,
or continue to help Kit
the get woman to Sarangu. Whose son he killed, whose yes. like 10-year-old son he killed.
And initially, he chooses to go after Turk.
Yep.
And this is where the film, I think, did he change his mind or did he lose the trail?
That's an interesting question. That hadn't occurred to me before. I think he knows which way they're going. I think he expects them to
head back to town to the bank. Yeah.
I think he gets to the point where he's like, yeah, they're definitely going this way. But I am legitimately at this point just leaving a woman alone in Apache territory. And this makes me a worse person than getting revenge would make me a good person or a strong person. I think that's the case. I think that, but I'm also a romantic. I also still, I'm like, I like romances. So, and to be clear, I don't feel like this movie is a romance. I think you could call it that, but it definitely, to me, doesn't feel like that is the main plot in this movie. In fact, this movie to me feels like it has two different plots, and they kind of And the second one doesn't even start until now. When
Kit
loses her horse from her wagon, and they hook the horse or the wagon up to Yellowleg's horse, and then run across a bunch of Apache braves who are chasing and shooting at a stagecoach. And then you see it a little bit closer, and the people dressed in top hats and dresses on the stagecoach are also Apache braves. And so they are literally just flying along the desert, hooting and hollering, shooting their guns and having a blast. It's basically a bachelor party. Mm-hmm. And so you have these, and Kit and Yellowlegs watch them from a distance, kind of see what's going on. And, you know, as the Apache move off, they're like, oh, whew, that's okay. We're safe. But Yellowlegs decides they need a second horse. And so he thinks that the Apache are close enough that he can go and presumably steal one of their horses, and says, Kit, you wait here. I'll be back. Which might not be the best idea.
No.
Turns out, as things turn out, he ends up, he does successfully steal one of their horses. But I think I need you to help me out here, because there's a lot that happens in very dark screens at this point.
Yeah, unfortunately. Yeah, as much as I kind of wish they did day for night, I think they did night for night.
I think so, too. It's very dark. And he sneaks into the camp, and there's something happens. I don't know if he wakes somebody up and has to punch them, or if he sneaks up on them and intentionally, I'm not even clear on if he actually kills one of them or not.
I don't know if he kills anyone. I think that's the whole point with later, when there is an Apache sort of tracking them. I think maybe it was the lookout, or maybe it was, like you said, maybe it was someone he disturbed while he was getting the horse and had to knock unconscious.
We do see him after Yellowlegs gets a horse. He shoots his gun to scare off all the other horses, presumably to keep them from, you know,
chasing after
them. And we see, just as he's about to ride off, one of them sits up and kind of looks at him. And there's kind of something going on where I on the screen, I couldn't tell if he was like holding somebody or if he was just dusting himself off. And like, but it's very clear to me that that's the one that starts tracking them. And so he somehow gains the attention of this warrior that then starts tracking them and taking pot shots at them to scare them.
Yeah, just playing with them.
And he plays with them like almost all the way to Siringo, like day after day after day. And this is like its whole own arc. It has no bearing on Turk or Billy. Those two never even know this guy exists. He's just following Yellowlegs, and Yellowlegs says at some point, oh yeah, he's got it in for me, he's got to pay me back or something like that,
right?
And
and I like Marina, how in the world could he miss? He didn't
Yeah. And then, you know, they lose a horse, and then they lose their second horse, but the Brave takes out their second horse, which really surprised me. I honestly thought it would make more sense for him to have stolen the horse and then continue stalking them. But I just would assume that they would have put more value on, you know, he would have maybe been like tit for tat, I'm going to take your horse because you took mine. But I guess maybe he was more obsessed with the game, quote unquote, than with getting a horse back. You know, maybe it was a thing where he's like, I'm not coming back until I've killed that guy. And, you know, who knows what the conversation was. And then we end up with, you know, there with Yellowlegs is waiting for him to show up, because he says, I'm going to be waiting for him the next time he comes because he killed my horse, which, you know, I'd feel the same way maybe. But yeah, he pulls an arrow out of the horse. And so definitely his horse, the first horse got a snake bite and had to be shot. The second horse was killed by the Indian for sure.
Oh, thank you. I didn't remember that at all. That's okay. Sorry.
So then they hole up in a cave. I'm literally just talking you through this whole movie.
Yeah.
I could just, you know, do an interpretive dance for you all and you could enjoy that part of it instead. But, and so then, you know, he says, stay here. If I'm not back by morning, you're on your own or something like that. And what the crap, guy. what the crap. And I had a moment because there are a couple of really high, like, steep angle shots in here where you can tell that this cave has an opening up at the top of it. Mm-hmm. And I had a moment where I thought, did he set her up as bait?
No, I don't think so.
No, I think that that might have made a lot of sense in this movie, but I don't think that it was intentional. I think it just was my brain jumping to the most suspicious possible.
Yeah, no, it turns out that this warrior was one step ahead of him. And so he knew where they were, and he was so managed to make his way down into this cave while Yellow Legs is off heading up to the ridge to watch out for the brave,
his approach,
for the warrior. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately for this Apache warrior, Yellow Legs left Maureen O'Hara with a loaded shotgun.
Yeah, which she's been pointing at people all movie. So
right.
To be fair, I love that. I like that they foreshadow this a bit. She points it at Yellow Legs. She certainly threatens Billy with it. He says, you know, what are you going to do with that rock? Are you going to hit me with it? And she says, I'll shoot you with a shotgun if I have to. You know, they keep foreshadowing she's going to have to shoot somebody. They did a really good job with it. I think the writing in this movie is very, very good. And I don't want to, I feel like at this point we shouldn't go any further.
No, I kind of agree.
They're not quite to Siringo, but they're almost there. And this is one of those movies I think it makes sense to tell you, hey, by the way, guys, if you haven't watched this movie yet, you should have.
Okay,
and
yeah.
I don't think we want to give away the ending of this because this movie is worth a watch.
All right, interesting. Yeah, it was a film that there's so much elements. There's the characters, as we were talking, the actors, there's some story elements and everything that I think are really interesting and I really like, but I'm having a hard time convincing myself that I actually liked the film.
Okay.
I don't think it's a bad movie. At all. Don't get me wrong. It's just, there's something I feel, there's just something about it that just won't click for me. And maybe it's just minor things. Maybe it's the fact that, like, the music, I think, is fairly awful throughout the film. It's at times very disjointed to what's going on. And the theme of the music and the style of music is bizarre, in my opinion.
The opening theme, I thought would really go well with, like, an Arthurian, like, swords and sorcery kind of movie. It doesn't scream Western to me, so there's definitely a little bit of strange there.
But there's even later on, there's just more, it's almost like jaunty plink, plink, plink music playing and stuff when they're just talking, you know, in the desert or walking through the desert. And this doesn't work.
Turk keeps whistling and humming the same tune. We all know it as The Ants Go Marching. But he's singing it as Johnny Goes Marching, I think. And I think we've adapted the words from what they were previously. He's singing an old kind of soldier marching song over and over and over. And they definitely reuse that in the background music with different tempos, different keys. And I think if you're not noticing that it's that song, it definitely sounds a little bit strange in the setting. To me, it clicked for me because it was that reference back to him whistling that at different points.
And I think I was annoyed. And again, like we said, we don't want to give away endings and stuff like that. But it's a 1960s film, and it's got a beautiful woman and a handsome man. there's romance involved.
Yeah.
I feel like the romance feels
forced.
Really? Forced a little bit. I'm not sure that in just a few days that the Kit Tilden is going to just forget that this guy shot her son.
Especially considering at one point he says, there's something you have to know about me. And she says, you killed the only person I loved. That's all I need to know about you. And then like a day or two later, it's not that all is forgiven, because he definitely does some things to help her. But yes, this is a compressed storyline. And when you're dealing with the death of a child, any time that you include then some kind of romantic entanglement especially from the mother, and that's probably not a fair comment on my part, but at least in Western storytelling, you know, having the mother then become romantically entangled with somebody for any reason other than sheer grief, like knee-jerk reaction, you know, is hard for us to accept as being the real thing.
I honestly thought there was a point in the film where I briefly wondered if Billy would somehow redeem himself and become the love interest.
Yeah. I don't like that idea.
No.
The more I think about it, the more like, no, Billy is a player. He might have an arc later, you know, outside of this, where some showgirl falls for him and he realizes he's got to have her, but it's not Maureen O'Hara. And I gotta say, like, the chemistry between the main characters in this actually is very good. Brian Keith and Miranda Hara together are very good. I think the problem is not who is playing the characters, but the situation that they're in. I think bringing them back together in The Parent Trap is a genius move. They're very good in it. There's definitely a lot of chemistry between them. But yeah, we're talking about a matter of days after her son was killed by this man. And even if it was an accident, I don't think that's something certainly as a modern viewing audience, are going to be able to accept easily.
Well, and it's also the very abridged romance where very few words are shared between them on camera. If they have any deep conversations, it's in between the scenes that we see.
Well, the only thing that matters is the bullet bra. Come on.
Yeah.
it is the 60s, and there are some very misogynistic views that are still being held from the 1960s, even today. There's a lot of difficulty with this time period. I think, especially when the movie was made, the umbrella is the example. Yes, women's complexions were important to them in the 1800s, but women living on the prairie were not delicate flowers carrying parasols around unless they were extremely wealthy. Mm-hmm. And so they're going to wear hats to shade their heads. That's probably the one massive oversight in this whole movie is Maureen O'Hara does not own a hat. But
you can't cover up her red hair, though. Come on, it's
really
Maureen O'Hara.
Yeah, you really can't. But the romance here is a 1960s perspective of romance.
Yeah.
It's not an 1800s perspective of romance, and it's not a 21st century perspective of romance. It is a 1960s. You have a reasonably good-looking man, and therefore every woman around him must be beautiful and must desire him. You know, he's basically James Bond in a cowboy hat.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a problem. The problem is when the movie was made, more than... you can make an argument for a compressed timeline and say, oh, maybe this trek actually took weeks or months and they had time to get to know each other and have conversations. And I feel like there were a couple of conversations here or there that if you really wanted to make an argument for it, you could say, well, they would have talked a lot more than that. They had days and days and days. You could also argue for the whole people in a stressful situation together have a tendency to bond. They're being hunted by this Apache. I think you can argue for it, but we're not going to accept it as modern audiences, and I don't expect people to.
I think I would find it a little easier to take if it continued to be or seem like a blossoming romance or a relationship.
Sure.
But by the end of this film, they're throwing the love, you know, the L word around. You know, she's like, she's telling, I
couldn't love a cold blooded killer.
Yeah, I'm like, wait, really love you love this guy? Yeah. If that hadn't been said, if it was just sort of the glances, exchange of looks, and the fact that, you know, he's ready to get to get some revenge, and then sees her and goes, oh, fine, you know, whatever, changes it, and you can tell by what's going on with the characters that it's her that's making him change his mind, or something that he does makes her change, you know, that would be fine, because then I could think, okay, they're going to go on beyond this and actually get to know each other, and then maybe they're going to fall in love.
Mm-hmm. And but, I think you can argue both ways on this. Again, you know, you could argue she's saying, well, I could love you as long as you're not actually a cold-blooded killer. Mm-hmm. I think you're right. I think it plays out the way that you're saying, that it sounds a lot like, oh, I love you, don't kill somebody, which, yeah, there's a problem with that. This is one of those weird movies where, like, a lot of it is really, really good, and it's also kind of really dark. And then it gets to the end, and it tries to force an ending that is
happy.
Happy-ish. And I don't, it's really hard not to get into it. The outcome of one of the characters feels a bit harsh to me, especially considering the outcome of another character is extremely lax to me. Definitely, I don't feel like the really bad guy gets what he deserves. And to, you know, the characters all have really interesting backgrounds and stories, but then at the very end, it kind of tries to wrap it all up in a neat little bow and be like, and then everything's fine. Forgetting that they're still in the middle of Apache territory with, like, no food or water.
Yeah, yes, our male and female leads literally walk off hand in hand.
Right off into the sunset, absolutely. And there are some problems with it. I think if they had gone for a truly kind of noir ending, where it was like, I mean, almost like a... I can't think of a good example of an ending that would be like this, but where kind of everybody dies. Game of Thrones. No, you know, if
the Wild Bunch. Go stick with Peckinpah. Go the Wild Bunch.
Yeah, where it's like, or, you know, Tombstone. Like, everybody kind of dies at the end, and it kind of might have made a little bit more sense. But as it was, it wasn't quite a romance. It wasn't quite noir. It was, I think, a beautifully shot Western. There are some excellent shots. There's one camera push that reminded me so much of the end shootout at the ranch at Silverado. I was just like, whoa, you know, gosh, this is 25 years before then, something like that. And, you know, the scenery, of course, it's filmed on location, so it's gorgeous. There's a lot about this movie that's really good. The acting, I think, is really good. And I genuinely think that the story overall is a really good story. I think when we start to pick it apart and go back and rewatch it over and over again, that's when we start to see the cracks in it. And it's, I don't know that it won any awards or anything like that. It's not a perfect movie.
I think I remember reading that the audiences didn't care for it, and there was some critical note, you know, some of the critics appreciated it, but it failed to kind of strike any chord with the audience.
That's how I feel with it. It's not a movie that I would watch to feel good, and it's not a movie that I would watch to feel like, ooh, chills, right? Yeah. It's kind of a, technically, from a technical perspective, I think it's very good in a lot of ways. I think the writing is very good, the acting is very good, but like you said, there's something a little bit disjointed where it kind of needs to be a sad ending. Because it starts off with a kid getting shot. Right. Like, it's hard to end a movie with a kid getting shot or a dog getting killed by a bear, or a cat getting run over, you know? I mean, like, the only movie that I can think of where it starts with somebody dying tragically and by the end of it you actually feel like life could be okay again is P.S. I Love You, and I hated that movie the first time I saw it. I hated that movie the first time. So there's not a big market for something tragic happening at the beginning that's really traumatic and disturbing, and then more bad things happening, but then at the end it's all just kind of okay. There's not a great market for that.
No. 10 years earlier, and our hero would have to die at the end.
Yes, or he'd have to be solidly a good guy with a white hat on from the very beginning and probably mm-hmm. sing a few songs in the middle of it.
Yeah, exactly. Good point.
And all the bad guys would have to die. Like, either the good guy has to die. Well, the main guy has to die because he's not perfectly good. You know, I thought of Algiers a minute ago. It's not Algiers. Mm-hmm. But, God, man, what a great movie. it's like it wants to be the Western Algiers, but it doesn't quite make it.
No, not at all. Yeah. So, as far as ratings go, I agree with all your points. I really do. It's just this film, I couldn't even bring myself to watch it a second time. I almost watch all our films twice.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of do the once real quick, or not real quick, but just watch it and let it wash over me.
Yeah.
And then go over the second time and then try to...
And pick it apart.
And pick it a little bit more.
Yeah.
This one, it just failed to resonate with me, and it to the point where it's just, I don't want to say I don't care, but... Yeah, I just couldn't bring myself to give it another watch.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if I had, would I think differently? And it might be a film that I'll have to revisit in the future just to try to say, am I giving this a fair shot? Let me try it again.
Mm-hmm.
So I might have done it a disservice, because that has happened to me before in the past where I've watched a film and went, oh, that was okay.
Mm-hmm.
And then I watched it a second time and went, wow, that's really good.
Yeah.
You know, or that's a lot funnier than when I didn't get that the first time.
Yes.
I got it this time.
Yeah.
Or, oh, you know what? I missed that line the first time I watched it. That's really important because that plays into this later on, and it
yes.
makes the whole movie. That has happened to me.
Yeah.
So, yeah, maybe I didn't give this one the fairest of shots that I could have.
Yeah.
Maybe my old bullet wound, you know, in my
your aim was off.
And my aim was off on this one.
It messed up your shot, yeah. So how would you rate this movie?
I would still – I'm going to give it a solid 3. And okay. I feel like that's the only fair rating that I can give it. I can't go lower than that because, as I say, maybe I was just in the wrong mood. Mm-hmm. Maybe I just didn't give it didn't give it that second watch that would have pushed me over the edge. But that's where I'm going to go with it, because I think that's the only one that's the only number I can come up with that I really think is fair.
Okay. Fair enough.
What about you, though? Because you definitely seem like you really got a lot out of this than I did.
I mean, this movie really caught me right at the very beginning. My first watch on it, there was a little bit of weirdness. Like Billy, her son, Billy is the actor's name. Mead is her son's name in the movie. There's this little boy standing on top of a roof playing a harmonica, which reminded me of Once Upon a Time in the West, because Once Upon a Time in the West is the weirdest Western ever, but it's so captivating. It has some elements that this movie reminded me. I suppose that maybe it reminds me of this movie, because Once Upon a Time in the West is actually a newer movie than this one. Is that right? That has to be right. Yeah, 1968. So actually, I guess Once Upon a Time in the West reminds me of this movie. That's an interesting... Wow, that kind of blew my mind. Both the movies that this reminds me of were made after it. So I wonder if they actually, you know, I'm reminded of them because they were influenced by this movie. There are a lot of silent shots in this film. Once Upon a Time in the West does that a lot. You have a lot of long silent shots. Silverado famously opens up with no sound. mm-hmm. at all. It's an incredibly bold way to start a movie. If we all know Silverado is hands down my favorite Western. I can't help it. I love The Angel and the Bad Man. But if you want to talk like old West cowboy movie, for me, it's Silverado. So there's a lot in this movie that reminded me of some films that are really well done. And with the concept that maybe they were influenced by this movie, which would be very, very interesting to learn. I am really kind of captivated with some parts of this movie. You saying that it was a critical success but not a popular success makes perfect sense to me. Mm-hmm. There are aspects of this film that are beautifully shot, strangely executed. I think I almost feel like it didn't go quite weird enough. Like, it was just on the edge of being so weird that it was like, what is going on with this movie? Like, I hate to use this as an example, but like a Clockwork Orange almost kind of situation where you're like, this movie is so weird that it just is overwhelmingly captivating. It misses that a little bit. It just sticks a little bit too close to tradition for it. So I think that the performances in this movie are very good. You know, I think 100% of the there's somebody that could say, oh, this guy would have been a better main character, or this girl would have been a better main character. I'm sure those people are out there. I'm sure that, you know, there are other actors that could have done these parts very well. But it works for me. The chemistry of all four of the kind of main characters, I feel like, is very good. So for me, sorry, I'm drawing this out a bit more than I meant to. I'm very close to giving it 5 stars, not because I think it's a perfect movie, but because I think that technically, from a technical perspective, there's enough good about this movie that if you enjoy watching film, you should watch this film. And maybe you need to watch it a second time. I definitely, like, I had intended to watch kind of the first half of the movie again, and I got caught up in it and watched all of it again. partly because I was like, what about this? What about that? But it does really feel almost like you almost have like a Dances with Wolves segment in it too. It's so strange, just because there's this weird interaction between the main guy and this, you know, native that's following him around. It's interesting. So I can't give it 5 stars or 5 oothles because it's not just the most mind. It doesn't rank up there with Rain. It doesn't rank up there with Algiers. But I think that it got close and just didn't quite tip over the edge. So for me, it's I think a very easy 4 oothles. It definitely is one where I would say, oh yeah, I think Christopher, you should go back and watch it again. I think if you go back and watch it, really focusing on it and paying attention to some of the shots and things, there are bits in it that feel very much like your stock 1950s Western. But there are also parts in it that I think feel a bit more advanced and a bit more technically good. I could be wrong. Maureen O'Hara thinks I'm wrong, but but I think there's enough interesting parts, kind of like almost side quests throughout this movie, that it's worth a little bit of consideration.
Yeah, no, I think it's going to be something I'll revisit, and maybe it'll be one of these things where I do it on a weekend afternoon when I'm wide awake. It's not the end of a long day or anything like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I think the whole decision to kill her son very close to the beginning, I think, really grabbed me. So there's probably an element of me just being surprised by certain things mm-hmm. that happened in this movie I wasn't expecting, and then therefore captivated by it. But
I think that would have been a hell of a move if all the synopsises that you read didn't include it.
Didn't give it away. Well, gosh, yes. You're describing Prometheus to me. When you walk into the theater, having avoided I did not see a trailer before I walked into Prometheus. Not one. No trailers. I didn't know a darn thing about it except that it was Ridley Scott. I walk into the theater, my brother and I sit down, and some genius stands up at the front and says, are you guys excited for this Aliens prequel? And I'm a little surprised my brother didn't walk to the front of the theater and punch that person. Because they deserve to be punched, by the way, if you're a person mm-hmm. that stands up in front of a theater and gives away. My mind would have been blown to get to the part where you know what it is now and not have known that, I would have crapped in my seat. I would have lost my mind. But yes, when you give away that huge twist, then when the chest burster starts popping out of her, it's not that shocking. But gosh, can you imagine if you had gotten to the movie theater, sat through the first half of the movie, and then a chest burster started coming out, you would have lost your mind.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, gosh, people, I appreciate a good synopsis, but maybe leave out the real kicker when you're buying something. Oh, okay, sorry, that was a rant. Gosh, that was a heck of a rant. I still have a lot of deep wounds from that, so.
That sounds like it.
Yeah, just don't spoil a movie for me. I literally don't watch trailers anymore. If I get 30 seconds into a trailer and think I'm going to want to see this and I'm in a theater, I literally close my eyes and cover my ears because they ruin trailers nowadays ruin everything. So, yeah, don't spoil a movie for me. We'll be arch enemies for the rest of our lives.
Trailers are pretty bad at it. My big beef is watching any kind of dramatic television show where it looks like it's going to be the end of a character, and that's the end of the episode, and then it goes, you know, next time, and then the character is very much alive, and like, what?
You literally just described why I will not watch an extremely popular franchise anymore. There's a film franchise that I will not watch because they keep pulling that. And if you guys know anything about me, you can probably guess what it is. I won't watch them because I think they're all the same and they keep bringing back dead people. And to me, if there's no true consequences, there's no true value. So yeah, you can't just keep killing people off and then bringing them back. You cannot wipe an entire universe history and then say, oh, but this is just an alternate universe. Primeval threw me off on that one. Gosh, guys, let's talk about all of the movies and films that disappointed us by completely wiping. Let's just Downton Abbey the crap out of the stuff. Yeah, I can keep going. I guess I should let this go now. But
yeah, we're getting really far off track here.
We don't do it very often, so I hope you guys will indulge us a little bit for this one. Hope also that you get a chance to watch The Deadly Companions, and I hope that you liked it as much as I did and more than Christopher did. And keep an eye out for other stuff from this director and these actors. I would like to see some more Brian Keith. I thought he was a real pleasant surprise in this, kind of a grim kind of guy, but I liked that. And now I have to look up more Steve Cochran.
Yeah, Brian Keith, I actually know, I won't say I know him well, but I remember watching the show, not Family Affair, but in the 1980s, he was in Hardcastle and McCormick.
Wow, I didn't realize that's him.
Yeah,
now
neither did
pull
I.
Up his profile again. That was such a great show. Oh,
I just remember the Coyote sports car more than I remember anything else about the show.
Oh my gosh, that's awesome. Oh, I need to find some episodes of that. It's been way too long. That was one of our favorite shows when I was a kid. I don't know if it was super clean. He was in The Wind and the Lion. If you guys haven't seen that movie, it's a 1975 Sean Connery and Katharine Hepburn. Such a good movie.
Yeah.
Really interesting.
I am actually interested in going back and watching some of his other films because I did like him in this. I liked him as an actor.
So it'll be fun to go back and watch some of this. Interesting to watch The Parent Trap the next time I see it and think, my husband likes to play a game of, you know, well, Robert Pattinson is Batman because he is a vampire. So it'll be interesting to go from, oh yeah, so he shot her son and then they got married and had twins that were hitting That'll be an interesting thing to see play out.
Keep it all in your universe.
Yes,
I like
exactly.
Well, I think that is going to do it for The Deadly Companions. Lydia, thank you very much. I'm sorry this one didn't grab me, and I will let you know if I ever give this one a second shot and if my opinion changes one way or the other.
We often disagree on the amount of likability on movies. Usually it's kind of reversed. I really tend to like the romantic ones. You really tend to not like them. It's kind of unusual for me to be a little bit more gung-ho about a movie that's not I don't think traditionally romantic. So it's always, it's so much fun to talk about these with you.
We will talk to everybody next month. Thank you very much for listening. Again, any thoughts on this film or anything you've heard us say, send an email to orphanedentertainment@gmail.com. Follow the link in the show notes to all the social media places, our Discord server, all that good stuff. Until next time, thanks again, everybody. Bye.
Bye.